Between the end of the Second World War and the early 21st century, Britain became multicultural, a process that offers lessons for modern Ireland, which has recently experienced its own transition towards a more diverse society. Irish immigrants were one of many groups who flocked to Britain during the 1950s and throughout later decades. Like other immigrant groups, they faced persistent hostility and discrimination, but over time created communities that changed the face of Britain, especially in its cities. A new book explores the history of multiculturalism in Britain, seeking to explain the contradictions in how that country reacted to immigration. It reveals a story of progress and cultural interchange, but also one in which politicians took advantage of anxieties over migrants and race for their own ends. That book, Multicultural Britain, A People's History, is written by historian Dr. Kieran Connell, who joins us to discuss this timely and often controversial topic. Kieran, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me. Show.
Now, you have personal experience of multicultural Britain through your family history and your upbringing. Tell us about that background and how it might have influenced your decision to write this book.
Sure. So my parents met and grew up together in the city of Birmingham. They'd sent me to school in a part of Birmingham, which at that school I went to, there was maybe three or four white children. Everybody else were from either South Asian backgrounds. They were from Caribbean, South Asia, West Africa, East Africa, etc. And so growing up in that environment as a white child, you have I had a very different understanding of multicultural Britain to the one which you generally see in the pages of newspapers or in terms of the speeches that are made by politicians. It was sort of, there was an everyday familiarity with ethnic diversity. So my first kiss was with a girl from a Yemeni background, my best friend, his parents were from Pakistan. And in that context, the things that become a focus of anxiety by politicians or in the media, things like celebrating, for example, different religious festivals or wearing different religious symbols to school, they're not a source of anxiety, they're just an everyday reality. And so that, alongside the fact that I have immigration within my own family history, so my great-grandparents came from County Cork, my grandmother came from Germany, there was a kind of familiarity with the different cultures that both Irish and German heritage comes with in my family growing up, I was keen to paint a different side of the story to what we generally hear. And I think that side of the story is, yes, there were problems, racism still exists, as we know in Britain, but there was also a kind of everyday familiarity with diversity, which I don't think is spoken about often enough in a British context.
So basically, you faced something that is greatly feared by the far right, which is that you were a white minority. You were in a very, very tiny white minority.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, if you think about somebody like Enoch Powell, who some of your listeners may be aware of, MP for Wolverhampton, then subsequently became an MP for South Down towards the end of his career. But he was most famous for his so-called Rivers of Blood speech, in which he painted this dystopian figure of a white minority under attack from this unwarranted so-called alien invasion. So that was his ultimate nightmare, was to have white children in a minority in an ethnically diverse school. My experience was a completely different one. And I would say that experience has been the foundation of my academic interest as a historian. That experience with diversity, that familiarity with diversity. And the point I try to make in the book is that my own experience is actually becoming the norm for a huge number of people, the length and breadth of Britain, whether that's places like London or Birmingham, which are well known for their diversity, but also new geographies too. So places like Milton Keynes, for example, a city which was only established in the mid-1960s, that city is now more diverse right now than even Birmingham was as recently as the 1980s. So it's increasingly, I argue, becoming a feature, a part of the fabric of modern Britain, to have this ethnic diversity written into the fabric of everyday life.
And did you face, I suppose, what would be called reverse discrimination?
No, in short, no. You know, there's always going to be tensions in any kind of social situation. There's always going to be some kind of tensions. Obviously, any school playground is going to have some type of bullying between one group of people and another. But I never experienced anything that you might call reverse racism. I always experienced it as being a positive and enhancing thing. Yes, I was called, for example, the Punjabi for white person, Gora. I was called a Gora, but I never took it as anything more than a bit of playground banter. And indeed, a lot of my friends taught me how to swear in Punjabi or count to 10 in Punjabi.
Have you found more useful?
Both equally useful in their own way. Let me put it like that. But no, but I think the reality is, I think that's a good example, actually, because we actually had our own way of talking. I call it a multicultural slang, which mixed in, as I say, Punjabi swear words with maybe a bit of Jamaican patois, inner city Brummie. You know, it was all mixed together. And actually, that to take a step back. I think that's, as I say, part of what it means to be British today, which is never reflected in the words of politicians, is to have these hybridized different identities, which people are now increasingly comfortable using side by side.
Now, in the book, you concentrate on, obviously, on Birmingham and the Irish experience there. Birmingham saw an influx of Irish immigrants during the 1950s. Tell us about those immigrants. Why were they in the city of Birmingham? What did they do there? How were they treated in the 1950s?
So like most immigrants from Britain's former colonies, whether that's Ireland or whether that's the Caribbean, whether that's South Asia, they often, in many cases, were recruited to work in the factories and foundries of Birmingham, whether that's working in car factories or whether that's building the M1 motorway, you know, to do manual jobs which were often unpopular with native English and British people. So, you know, they were often recruited because they were a cheap source of labour. And the Irish, I think, did experience discrimination in a similar way to the experiences of people who had, you know, black skins or brown skins. So, you know, one of the things I heard most from the people I talked to when I wrote this book was the signs that were placed in bed and breakfasts: no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. Undoubtedly, that discrimination was a real feature of what Irish people experienced. And, you know, you see that in a whole variety of different ways. So you had a reluctance to rent rooms to Irish people in B&Bs. You had some pubs which refused to serve Irish customers. And that discrimination definitely got worse when the IRA's bombing campaign reached England. And so you had the Birmingham pub bombings in 1974, Manchester pub bombings, attacks in Brighton as well. And what happened in the aftermath of those bombings was that discrimination reached a whole new level for the Irish. So you had examples where certain British employees would refuse to work shifts with Irish employees. Certain shops would refuse to stock Irish goods. You had even some examples where there was a refusal to carry Irish passengers on airliners. So I think the Troubles had a really, really big impact. But the broader point, I think, is that there was still this hangover from the colonial era of stereotypes about the Irish, which associated them as being, you know, backward or drunkards or prone to fighting one another in the streets. And I think there were definitely similarities between the way in which the Irish were treated and the way in which black or South Asian migrants were treated, but for one really important distinction, which is that the Irish were white.
Yeah.
And if you're white, you can walk down the street and not immediately be visible as being Irish. Whereas if you're a black or South Asian, that's a very, very different situation.
You have to open your mouth before you're identified as such and not immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, one, I was astonished, I must say, by this figure. 1961, there were 644,000 Irish immigrants in England and almost 10% of them living in Birmingham. You also highlight a major incident in Birmingham in 1968 in your own neck of the woods, Bolsall Heath, involving about 20 Irish traveller families who settled in the area. What happened there?
Yeah, so Bolsall Heath, that's the area that I went to school in the 1990s. But what happened in 1968 was that a traveller community had set up shop on a patch of disused land in this inner city area. Now, Bolsall Heath, just for your listeners, was a rundown area, very poor quality housing, outside toilets, no hot water, no central heating in some cases. And partly for that reason, it was home to large numbers of immigrants from all over the world, because this was where the cheapest housing was available. So I think what happened was this traveller community probably thought, well, it's a rundown area. Maybe this will be a place where we can kind of live for a short period and not face too much hassle. But in fact, the opposite was true. So what happened was there was a huge amount of anxiety and resentment towards this traveller community from, for example, from the parents of local children who threatened to withdraw their children from school until that traveller site was moved on, from politicians who argued that this traveller site was the most filthy and disgusting that they'd ever come across. And in the end, what actually happened towards the end of the summer of 1968 was that the city council brought in dozens of police officers to essentially force the travellers to move on. They dug what was described as a quote-unquote anti-tinker ditch around that site to stop the travellers being able to come back at any point in the future. So what I argue in the book is that there was a huge amount of anxiety focused on the immigrant communities of these inner city areas. They were seen as being a source for the kind of poor quality nature of the houses and the nature of the communities more generally in these areas. And I think there was a sense that if this one traveller community were removed, that might solve all these wider problems that were understood to blight the area. So it's a good example, I think, of the way in which, and this, interestingly enough, this traveller community also included some settled members of the Irish community as well who were unable to find work for various reasons. But I think it's a good example of the way in which some Irish communities were the focus of this much broader anxiety, not just about the way in which the inner city had changed in the post-war years, but also I think the kind of the ghost that's hanging over this entire history is the fact that Britain in this period had moved from being a nation which had an empire that covered one third of the world's landmass in 1945 to, by the time we get into the late 60s and early 1970s, basically that empire had crumbled away. And I think that is the kind of, as I say, it's the ghost hanging over this entire story, that Britain's inability to process its transition from an imperial nation to a post-imperial nation.
Now, you've also already highlighted the problematic relationship between the Irish community in Birmingham and the people of Birmingham in the wake of the Birmingham bombings. To some extent, perhaps, can you view the attitude of people in Birmingham towards the Irish through the prism of the St. Patrick's Day Parade?
You know, so that's a good example. So the St. Patrick's Day Parade first emerged in Birmingham in the 1950s. Thousands of people would take part in it every year. You know, it's part of a broader sense in which in the 50s and 60s, the Irish were sort of becoming settled in Birmingham in particular, but in Britain as a whole. So in various parts of Birmingham, you'd be able to buy Irish newspapers. In Irish pubs, the songs like The Wild Colonial Boy would be sung, sometimes to a button accordion, traditional Irish button accordion. So they were becoming settled as a kind of feature of everyday life in Birmingham and in Britain. But then with the pub bombings, that changed things drastically. And with the discrimination that I've already talked about that came in the aftermath of the pub bombings, I think what happened was that the Irish community turned in on themselves and sort of were reluctant to celebrate their Irishness because they knew that if they put their head above the parapet, that could lead them open to discrimination in various forms. And the St. Patrick's Day Parade didn't run for the next, I think, 22 years after the Birmingham pub bombings. And it's only in more recent times that Irish people or people from the Irish diaspora in Birmingham have felt confident enough, I think, to celebrate their Irishness. And right now, Birmingham's St. Patrick's Day Parade actually is one of the biggest in the world.
Now, I mean, you obviously, it's clear that Irish migrants did experience persistent discrimination in Britain. But as you note in the book, ultimately, it was non-white racial minorities who bore the brunt of community tensions, wasn't it?
100%. And I think this is where we have to be careful. So there were parallels to be drawn between the Irish and black and South Asian migrants. But the crucial distinction is race. And the fact that if you're black and you're Asian and you're living in a majority white society, you're immediately visible as such and you have to carry on your shoulders the burden of all the stereotypes associated with quote-unquote blackness. And I think the thing that shows that most clearly is in 1962, the British government introduced the first legislation designed to curb immigration in the 20th century, the Commonwealth Immigrants Act. And the aim, straightforwardly, was to restrict the ability of black and South Asian migrants to enter into Britain.
The Irish were exempt, weren't they?
This is the key point, though. Mm. So they sold it to the public. They couldn't come out and say, we want to stop all black and Asian immigrants. So they sold it to the public as being about stopping, quote-unquote, unskilled migrants. Vast majority of migrants from places like Jamaica, Pakistan and India would have been unskilled, that's true. But the Irish were exempt, and the vast majority of Irish migrants coming into Britain were also unskilled, which demonstrated the kind of barefaced racism behind that piece of legislation, but also demonstrates the distinction between the experience of Irish migrants and the experience of black and Asian migrants in Britain.
And the non-white immigrants, when did they start to come in numbers? I mean, are we talking about the 1960s? I mean, the Irish have been coming for more than a century at this, since the famine, basically. But obviously the 1950s was huge. Are we talking about the 1960s?
Small black presence in Britain in the 19th and early 20th century, but really the black and Asian migrants start coming in big numbers after the Second World War. So from 1945 onwards. And the really important thing to keep in mind is that they came at the request of the British government, because Britain in the late 40s and 50s had a severe labour shortage. There were simply not enough workers, not just to keep the economy ticking over, but also to establish the welfare state, to establish things like the National Health Service. So I don't think it's an overstatement to say that the National Health Service, just to take one example, it simply wouldn't have been possible without migrant labour of one kind or another, but especially migrant labour from Britain's former colonies.
Mm. Now, to an Irish audience, Enoch Powell's 1968 Rivers of Blood speech seemed to come out of nowhere. Would that be how it would have been perceived in Britain, in Birmingham?
So I think Powell was an opportunist that spotted there was a market, unfortunately in my view, but there was a market for this brand of populism that would scapegoat migrants. It didn't come out of nowhere, no. There would have been anti-migrant sentiment expressed, to take one example, in 1958, a series of race riots broke out in London and Nottingham. They consisted of essentially white people targeting black passers-by, targeting their property, smashing their windows. In one case, it led to a death in 1959 of a black member of the public. And I think those events have actually eerie parallels with the unrest that took place both in Dublin last year and across the UK in the August just gone.
And in Belfast.
Exactly, in Belfast as well. So, you know, I think there's a very strange and eerie parallel between what happened there. But what was striking about that was the lesson that the British government learned was that there was not a problem with white racism. The problem was too many ethnic minority immigrants. And Powell spotted that there was clearly a demand among a certain constituent for a politician that would sort of vocalise some of these more extreme views. And it's worth keeping in mind that in 1958, the people were crying, let's lynch the blacks. So if you judge them by their own words, this was an out-and-out racist riot.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you reject the term race riots. You think they should be called racist riots.
I think race riots is almost a bit of a euphemism. I mean, what was occurring on these streets was groups of white people attacking black people and saying they wanted to get the blacks. And I think we should take them at their own word in that sense.
Are there lessons here for Ireland, do you think, in the British experience?
I mean, obviously, the immigration debate now has become a live one in Ireland in a big way. And I think it's really a fascinating period that we're living through in terms of Irish history, whereby we're moving from a period where the term diaspora in Ireland generally means the people who've left Ireland. And now what we're having in Ireland, whether it's Dublin or elsewhere, is we're having whole new generations of migrants who are starting to think about diaspora as something that exists in an Irish context. And I think the lesson of the British experience with multiculturalism is that over a period of 70 years, governments, whether it's the Labour Party or the Conservative Party, have essentially allowed the far right to set the terms of the debate in one way or another. And I'll give you one example of that. You may remember the recent policy of the previous Conservative government was to send asylum seekers to have their claims processed in Rwanda. That policy was first proposed by the neo-Nazi British National Party in the 1980s. And that's just one example of the way in which the UK debate has been dragged to the right by a succession of far-right demagogues. And Enoch Powell would just be one among many examples. So I think the lesson for the Irish in terms of how they deal with the question of Ireland now becoming a multicultural society is that you cannot seek to appease the far-right. If you do try and appease the far-right, all that you do is legitimise far-right ideas and racism. There needs to be a principled stance, I think, that not just values the work that immigrants are doing, but also celebrates the fact that Ireland is now becoming an ethnically diverse society, and in some ways has already become that.
It's a superb read that ranges far beyond the Irish experience, obviously, exploring other immigrant communities in Birmingham, Cardiff, Nottingham and Bradford. Dr. Kieran Connell, many thanks
for
joining us on the programme, on The History Show, to talk about Multicultural Britain, A People's History, published by Hearst and Company. And after the break, we'll be hearing about the history behind Dracula and Frankenstein and Bram Stoker and Mary Shelley's family connections to County Donegal. Stay with us.